KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's opening hour of Forum, we move forward with our election coverage by focusing in this hour on California Proposition 73, which would mandate parental notification before minors could have an abortion. We'll hear from both sides, and we'll hear from you by phone and email. Forum is coming up after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. In this morning's opening hour, we want to focus our attention on the upcoming California election, and we're going to begin with a discussion of Proposition 73 as we continue talking about propositions on the state ballot throughout the week. This would mandate parental notification before a minor can have an abortion, and we're going to hear from both sides on this. It is one of those propositions that seems to have sort of flown under the radar screen, but we feel certainly deserves a good deal of attention, and there's a good deal of controversy on this, as you well might imagine. Alban Romberg is joining us on the pro side. He is senior advisor for Proposition 73 campaign and joins us from his office in the state capitol in Sacramento. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Happy to be here this morning.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have Maggie Crosby, who is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union, opposed to this proposition, joins us from her hotel in Boise, Idaho. And welcome, Maggie Crosby.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. We're also say good morning to Catherine Short, who is legal director with the Life Legal Defense Foundation, and she joins us from her office in Ojai, California, and had a good deal to do with, I guess, writing this legislation. Did you not, Catherine Short?
Yes, that's correct.
Glad to have you here. Also glad to have Dr. Norma Jo Waxman in studio. She's assistant clinical professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and a physician at San Francisco General. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, that's the lineup. Alban Romberg, I'm going to begin with you. We generally do begin with the pro side. This, I guess, from your perspective, is necessary in the sense that any medical procedure ought to be approved by a parent, so why shouldn't an abortion?
That's correct. It's a very common sense measure, and it's frankly meant to restore the rights of parents, which have been taken away primarily by court actions, in case in California, and this will give an opportunity for a direct democracy to take its effect, and the voters will have an opportunity to vote to restore parents' rights with respect to an abortion performed on a young daughter that is 17 years and under.
And this only has to do with notification?
Only notification. It's not consent. According to current law, minors, no matter how young they are, they can be, in principle, 10 years old, they have, in effect, an absolute right to have an abortion. So this only involves notification of one parent or a guardian.
A lot of the reasoning behind the legislation that's presently on the books was that children who come from an abusive background or maybe even a child who was raped would not necessarily be able to go to their parents or would not go to their parents and feel safe about it.
That's true, and that's one of the reasons why this legislation is so important, because without either the intervention of a parent or guardian or in a juvenile court, which of course has the legal right and the authority to bring in child protective services, the abuse can continue. If the minor simply goes to an abortion clinic and has an abortion and perhaps is even then provided, as often is the case with birth control, and sent back into the abusive situation, this results in many cases in a series of abortions and continuing abuse and sexual exploitation of the minor. So that's one of the reasons why we call this initiative Parents' Right to Know and Child Protection, because it helps protect minor children from those kinds of ongoing abusive situations, which may, in some cases, include the parents. But in many other cases, minors frequently are having a sexual relationship with an older man, and the abortion and continuing provision of birth control can just facilitate the ongoing exploitation. And we've known and done research that most of the abortion clinics do not report the sexual abuse of minors, partly because they have a vested interest in providing abortions, and as they say, they don't want to chill minors' access to those services. So that's one of the main reasons that this initiative is important, because it protects minors through the agency of their parents in most cases, and then where necessary, the juvenile courts and child protective services.
Again, Alban Romberg with us from Sacramento, a senior advisor for Prop 73. He is obviously in favor of this, and in favor of this, maybe we ought to come at it from another angle just for a moment, if you could, Alban Romberg. That is, a lot of those in the for uses of clear distinction pro-choice movement have raised a lot of red flags and say that this is language that's going into the Constitution having to do with the unborn, and therefore it's really a setting up a kind of slippery slope to move toward outlawing abortion.
Well, I'd make two points on that. First of all, laws like this are in place in over 30 states, and they have not led to an erosion of Roe v. Wade. If this was the way, if this was an avenue to erode Roe v. Wade, it's singularly ineffective, because this has been in effect for over a decade in many states, and Roe v. Wade has not been eroded. The second point I'd like to make is we were, of course, aware that that would be an argument against it. So our final statement in the initiative, and it's one sentence which I would like to read, it says, except for the rights, duties, privileges, conditions, and limitations specifically provided for in this initiative. Nothing in this initiative, the technical word is section, shall be construed to grant, secure, or deny any other rights, duties, privileges, conditions, and limitations relating to abortion or the funding thereof. And throughout, we've always made clear, for example, the question about the definition of abortion, which uses the word unborn child. It says very clearly, and I read it, it's the first section, and I read the end, this is the beginning, for the purposes of this section, the following term shall be defined to mean. And again, it's only for the purposes of this, and this has only to do with notification of a parent or guardian with the necessary exceptions for medical emergencies and for abusive situations where there's a judicial bypass. So we've circumscribed it from the beginning and the end to make it clear. It's a self-contained language which only relates to abortion and to the notification of a parent or guardian or juvenile authorities in the case of a minor seeking an abortion, that is someone 17 under. It's only that, and if words mean anything, we've been very explicit about circumscribing this to mean just what it says and no more.
If it is circumscribed and self-contained and only refers to notification, Maggie Crosby, why is the ACLU and so many others so concerned about this going into the Constitution and making abortion inaccessible?
Well, let me say, first of all, that this initiative would put all 8 pages into the state constitution, and there is no other state that has restrictions on teen abortions in the state constitution in this way. So Alvin Ronberg's statement that, gee, if you just look at other states, there hasn't been a problem, that's because no one else has done this, which is to say right in our state's highest law that an abortion is causing the death of, quote, the unborn child, a child conceived but not yet born, to recognize in our Constitution that a fertilized egg is the equivalent of a child can have very far-reaching consequences, totally beyond the issue of abortion, for such matters as stem cell research or fertility treatment. So we are very concerned about the way in which this is being done. But let me step back and address the larger issue, which is the whole issue of whether California wants to mandate parental involvement in teens' abortions. Alvin Ronberg said that this was a right that was taken away by the courts. Actually, since the 1950s, California has allowed teens to get all pregnancy-related care without parental involvement, and that's because it's just not treated as routine medical care. Everyone recognizes that there's no reason to think that that parental involvement is a barrier for such things as getting an aspirin, but that there is a substantial percentage of teens who just won't get medical care if they have to go to their parents with the explosive news of a pregnancy. Now, California did enact in 1987 a law that would have required parental consent for minors' abortions, and I represented a distinguished coalition of healthcare providers, the American Academy of Pediatrics, California Medical Association, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and Planned Parenthood. And by the way, every leading medical organization is opposed to Prop 73 to challenge that in court. And every court that took a look at the experience of other states with parental involvement laws would not allow this to take effect in California because they said that while this may sound benign for all the reasons Alvin Romberg just said, in the real world, it does nothing to help families and does a great deal to put teenagers in danger.
Does it, in your judgment, act as a catalyst toward more self-induced or back alley abortions?
Yes, it does, because what happens is that with no law in the books, about 60% of teens do go to a parent. But if teens can't safely go to their parents, no matter what the law is, those numbers don't change. And so what you see in other states is that some percentage of extremely resourceful teens navigate through the court system and get a court order. And I mean, think about that in the real world. Does it really make sense to send a pregnant teenager to a judge? She's already scared. She's lonely. She can't talk to her dad. She can't talk to her mom. Do we really want her going to a judge? But some teens do. That delays access to abortion. Some teens could no more go to court than fly to the moon. And so what happens to them? Some travel out of state to get health care after a Greyhound bus trip. And some teens do turn in desperation to dangerous self-induced procedures. And so in every way, this does nothing to help families, but it does a great deal to cause teens to avoid getting health care, or at least delay getting health care. And for some, the consequences can be tragic.
So you're obviating what Mr. Romberg said is the importance of the judicial waiver or bypass that's part of this proposition?
Oh, you know, we looked in our case very closely at what happens in the teenage abortion docket in other states. And what we saw is that even in the states where it works as well as it can work, it's an extremely stressful, humiliating process. There's a loss of confidentiality. It's extremely difficult for the teens, and it delays access to abortion. But what's worse is that there are many places in which the system just doesn't work. In Pennsylvania, somebody did a study that showed that teens who called court clerks got accurate information out of only 8 of the 60 counties, so, you know, and then you have these clerks saying, well, honey, I just think you have to go out and hire a lawyer. I have no idea. And there are places where the judges simply won't grant waivers. And, you know, in Florida, for example, Florida has just begun to enforce its parental involvement law. And we're beginning to hear stories that, for example, in some courts, they posted a list of all of the names of teens who were coming in to get abortions outside the courtroom. I mean, obviously, that's wrong, and it's not the way the system should work. But that's the kind of thing we see when we set up a system where we tell pregnant teenagers that they should go, you know, through crowded courthouses to get court orders. I mean, imagine this in California. Imagine just the distances. Imagine 100 languages are being spoken. I think it's going to be a total disaster.
And Maggie Crosby with us this morning from Idaho is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. Catherine Short is legal director of the Life Legal Defense Fund. She joins us from her office in Ojai, California, and had a good deal to do with writing this legislation. I'd like, Catherine Short, your response to the sense that this is really about making abortion more inaccessible, that there is a kind of pro-life agenda to this legislation, and it's not just about parental notification.
I'd like to respond to just about everything that Maggie Crosby said to begin with.
Let's begin with that just overview from your perspective. That is, is this scare tactics from pro-choice movement as you see it?
Indisputably, yes. I mean, they have no evidence. She talks about minor self-inducing abortions and getting illegal abortions. There is no evidence of minors doing that in these other states where you have the record going back, again, 10, 20 years. Of this, and there's no evidence of harm to minors from self-induced abortions or anything like that. And the implication is somehow this minor is not going to be able to get what is going to happen here, and what we see in the other states is that the clinics, a minor doesn't call a courthouse. What she does is she's going to a clinic, and the clinic says, okay, here are your options. Your options are you tell your parents, or we will send a notice to your parents, or you can go to court, and here are the forms you fill out, because this is all, you know, done on pre-printed forms. She doesn't have to hire a lawyer or anything like that. It's all going to be, you know, established forms. Here are the forms. You take these to room 503 in the courthouse on A Street, and you file them, and you wait, and they'll give you a hearing date, and that's how it will be handled. And it'll be handled, you know, by the second court day after filing. And, you know, it's not going to be, a minor takes a home pregnancy test and then, you know, calls the court.
You're saying the teens aren't going to have to navigate through the court system on their own?
No, I mean, they will be appointed a guardian when they get to the court, and they can have a lawyer appointed to them if they would like a lawyer. They're not on their own in doing this between say, the clinics and the court personnel. It's not like they're going to have to figure this out themselves. I mean, the idea that somehow this minor who can't fill out these forms is nevertheless going to be able to locate, you know, an illegal abortion someplace. You know, I wouldn't know how to find an illegal abortion. You know, would you? Would you know how to, you know, travel down to Mexico, find an illegal abortion? I wouldn't know where to start. But these, you know, that obviously the system, as we saw when the parental consent law, when it was getting ready to be implemented, the courts came up with forms. They came up with procedures that you know, went even beyond the law in terms of protecting the confidentiality of minors. You know, the hearings would be held at times, you know, not the same time every week, so people wouldn't know that this was when the minors come in for their waivers. I mean, they bent over backwards to preserve the confidentiality of minors. So I just the idea that this, I think there's an interesting contradiction. Ms. Crosby said that, you know, the same number of teens tell their parents before and after. Well, what she's citing is a study that found that something like 40% of teens in one state were getting waivers. Obviously, first of all, I think that study was flawed in because that number is totally out of line with the official records that are kept in various states of how many teens get waivers. But it shows that it really wasn't very much of a obstacle if that many minors could get waivers.
Let me go back though to the direct question I asked you: is this all about parental notification, self-enclosed, as Mr. Romberg said, or is there another agenda here?
It is about parental notification. Now, I mean, you say, well, why are there so many pro-lifers behind it? Because we see the experience of other states is that these laws reduce teen abortions and teen pregnancies. We're not replacing every teen abortion with a teen birth. Both abortion rates and teen pregnancy rates go down. And this is something that both sides should be seeking, I mean, should want to do. I mean, they claim we're interested in reducing teen abortion and teen pregnancy rates, but here is a step that has been proven to do that.
There's been a 40% decline, at least according to statistics I've seen, in teen pregnancy in California.
No. Yes. Read the fine print. It's teen births.
No.
That's the only thing that they keep a record of, okay? That's the only thing there's an official record of is teen births.
I think Dr. Actually, Waxman will contest that, but please
let me finish then about before we get to that. What the statistic about the decline in teen pregnancies is based on an extrapolation that the Alan Guttmacher Institute did. They said, well, we will assume for California what the national averages are. Well, two-thirds of the rest of the states have parental involvement laws in place. And so they are assuming for California what is going on in the rest of the country, which is teen involvement laws, which are lowering those rates for those age groups. So there are no numbers. We have no idea what's going on with the teen pregnancy and teen abortion rate in California.
Again, Catherine Schroeder is legal director of the Life Legal Defense Foundation with us from OHI. Dr. Norman Joe Waxman is here with us in studio, and she is assistant clinical professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at UC San Francisco and physician, San Francisco General Hospital. You dispute those figures?
Yeah, actually, we should be very proud in California that we know now that California teens in 15 to 17 have a greater than 40% decrease in their teen pregnancy rate, which is actually a greater decrease than what we've seen in the general United States. There is also, to be proud of, a 51% decrease in birth rate and 45% decrease in teen abortion rate in California. These are California statistics. These are statistics gathered in California. I don't have that off the top of my tongue. It's been published recently by the Center for Reproductive Health Research and Policy, but they're California state statistics that were gathered. And the thing that we can know that is that this is not due to parental notification laws, that this is due to the provision of excellent reproductive health care in California. We have comprehensive sex education, which includes abstinence, but also includes contraception and sex education in schools. We also have clinics and counselors throughout the systems that provide health care, both in schools and in public health clinics and private offices, that help understand teens how to take care of themselves, how to delay onset of sexual activity. And we've seen a delay in sexual onset of sexual activity and an increase in contraceptive use.
So you're wearing a button here that says, no on Prop 73, keep teens safe. What is the logic behind keeping teens safe by not having parental notification?
Well, what we know, and I think Maggie pointed out, is that teens who are faced with these kind of laws do a number of things. One, as a physician and as a provider of health care for teens and families, we always want teens to talk to parents. And it was mentioned that greater than 60% of all teens do. We know as they get younger, that's even greater. 75% of 15-year-olds, greater than 90% of 14-year-olds talk to their parents in the event of a pregnancy. What we also
know, by the way, we'll get back to that.
What we also know is that teens delay seeking care. Teens are already greater than two times more likely than an adult to not present in the first trimester of their pregnancy. And what we see in other states is that that states that have enacted these laws have an increase in second trimester procedures. We also find, And that's been borne out in studies in a variety of states. But we also find that teens do go out of state. So with the decrease in abortion rates that they're quoting that occur in the states that have enacted notification involvement laws, what has been found is that the surrounding states show an equivalent rise in abortions in teens.
We're coming up on a break. I wanted to give you an opportunity, Catherine Chart. You disputing figures in terms of teens talking to parents, yeah?
Yes, I know exactly the study that she is referring to. It's Henshaw and Cost from 1992. What they are doing is combining the figures for how many minors told their parents versus and how many minors' parents found out another way. The real figures for how many minors told their parents was 45%, and even of 14-year-olds, it's only got as high as 55%. Those are the genuine figures from that study.
Right, Dr.
Actually,
Waxman, yeah.
We have more recent studies than that, Karen. And one of the things, a recent UCLA study of California teens actually showed that of teens 14 to 17 years old, 79% said their parents knew of their sexual activity. We also have a study that looked at Wisconsin and Minnesota, two states that are very similar in demographics, but one with parental consent and one without. And 64 and 63% of the teens in those states told their parents about their abortions. So it really was not, there is no increase in teens talking to their parents because of these laws.
The bottom line is, you are opposed to this because you feel teens need the protection.
Teens need protections. And government, I'm also opposed to it because government can't mandate teens to talk to their parents. We want our teens to talk to us. And that is because we want to be involved. I'm a mother of two young girls. I think it's incredibly important that people talk to their teens, be involved with their teens. And we know that studies have shown that parents who are involved and have loving relationships with their children have teenagers then who confide in them about their sexual activity. They also have lower rate of early birth. They have a lower rate of STDs. So we know that good parental communication is critical for teen health. This law won't do that.
I'm going to open our phone lines and invite those of you listening to join us, and you can do that now. You can join us at our toll-free number if you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation. Any question or comment is welcome. You can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. That's toll-free from wherever you're listening to Forum or however, on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Our toll-free number for your calls is 866-733-6786. You can also email any comments or questions you have to us. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. Talking with Dr. Norma Jean Waxman from UC Medical Center and San Francisco General Hospital, with Catherine Short from the Life Legal Defense Fund, Maggie Crosby from the American Civil Liberties Union, and Alban Romberg, who is Senior Advisor for Prop 73 campaign. And your calls and emails when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. In the second hour of this morning's Forum, we'll talk about breast cancer, prevention, funding, research, and more. Tomorrow on Forum, an hour all about surveillance cameras, and an hour on two educational propositions, 74 and 76. We continue our election coverage, looking at California state propositions later this week, and we also will be talking with Quincy Troop, poet and writer, and doing an hour on the new DeYoung Museum. And we'd like to hear from you. If you have thoughts about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear on Forum, let us know what they are. You can email us, forum@kqed.org, or call our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300, and visit us on our website. You can find our archives there. Go to www.kqed.org. Thank you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to supporters and opponents of Proposition 73, which would require parental notification before minors could have an abortion. And we're going to go to your calls and emails forthwith here. Just want to remind you who's with us. Alban Romberg is senior advisor for the Prop 73 campaign. He's with us from Sacramento. Maggie Crosby is an attorney with the American Civil Liberties Union. She's with us this morning from Boise, Idaho. Catherine Short, who wrote the legislation, was involved in writing the legislation, is legal director of the Life Legal Defense Foundation, and she's with us from Ojai, California. And with us in studio is Dr. Norma Jo Waxman, assistant clinical professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, and also a physician at San Francisco General Hospital. We're going to go to your calls here, and Gail, I think we have you on the line here, don't we? Hi, Gail. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. I'm a mother. I have a daughter, and I would absolutely hope that she would come to me with any type of problem that she had. She's an adult now, but my real concern is that the insertion of the phrase unborn child into this proposition is a clear indication to me that with the construction of the Supreme Court as it is now and probably will continue to be with the next nominee, that this is one of many laws that are being inserted across the country to be used as precedent to at least eventually overturn Roe v. Wade.
Catherine Short, I think what we're hearing from this caller is concern that we're hearing from many who feel that this is, again, chipping away at Roe v. Wade, and you would say what?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that Roe versus Wade in no way is inconsistent with parental consent laws. The Supreme Court has upheld parental involvement laws. The Supreme Court has, in fact, upheld parental involvement laws, both notification and consent. I mean, in the Casey decision in 1992, which specifically reaffirmed Roe versus Wade, it also upheld Pennsylvania's parental consent law. So there is no inconsistency between Roe versus Wade and parental involvement. The second thing is, I think the issue is, in our definition of abortion, are we describing what a procedure that is done in clinics? I mean, if that procedure isn't done, then I guess we've wasted a lot of time and money. But if that, in fact, is the procedure that's being done, then they have to give notice. It's kind of that clear. So to get into the idea that a judge, or it wouldn't be a judge, you would have to be talking about Supreme Court justices, are going to look at this definition and then all slap their foreheads and say, oh, my goodness, it's an unborn child. I guess we better make abortion illegal. I mean, that's just... It's just absurd. The opponents keep raising this issue, but it's clearly just the sort of thing that it's from the playbook, How to Defeat a California Initiative. You claim that it's going to have all these unintended consequences. I mean, what they can't even specify exactly how this law would be used. It's just they're just trying to scare people.
Well, Maggie Crosby, let's get you in on this.
Yeah, I'll specify. Katie, it's not absurd. Let's start from the perspective that The way abortion is generally defined, in California, for example, our health and safety code says abortion means the induced termination of any pregnancy except for the purpose of producing a live birth. That's a typical, straightforward, clinical definition of abortion. So why do the proponents have this incredibly unusual, loaded definition, causing the death of the unborn child, a child conceived but not yet born? That language is going to be engraved into our state constitution. And so decades from now, as our courts confront a whole host of reproductive technologies, of regenerative medicine that comes from embryonic stem cell research, they are going to be confronted with this language in our state constitution that equates a fertilized egg, an embryo, with a child. California has never recognized a fetus as a child. In fact, the California Supreme Court specifically said in 1969, in striking down our criminal abortion law before Roe versus Wade, that California does not equate a fetus with a child. Now, this will be a change. And the caller is absolutely correct that it comes at a particularly critical time for reproductive rights. when the fate of Roe versus Wade is absolutely in the balance. And if Roe versus Wade is overturned, what protects California women and their childbearing choices is our state constitution. And so it's absolutely not the time to tamper with our California constitution's strong protection for reproductive choices.
Let me get more of our callers on. And Michelle, you're next. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Thank you. I have, I'm a physician. I work for a county hospital, Santa Clara Valley Medical Center. And I have concerns about the safety of my patients, but I'm also worried about the burden that Prop 73 imposes on doctors. And I think some of them will choose to stop treating patients younger than age 18.
Do you agree, Norma Jo Waxman?
Yeah, I think that's quite a concern for many of us. It's the reporting laws in described in this are sort of onerous both for physicians and for the judges. The judges will be required to show their votes and or show their the teens that they've approved, and those numbers are available for the public. I also feel that it's important to point out that 90% of teens who cannot tell their parents do confide in another loving adult, be that their aunt, their grandmother, a clergy member, a teacher, an older sibling, and those loving relationships are not validated by this law. There's no exception made for those, and there's also no exception made in the setting of abuse, as in 13 other states that have created these laws have made the exception for abuse, and that is not written for in this law.
Isn't your argument also that the poor and minority populations would be most affected by this law? Why?
Yeah, Michael, I'm really glad you brought that out, because there's a great deal of disparities that we've found in abortion and pregnancy-related issues, reproductive health in this country. In a 2002 AGI survey of greater than 10,000 women nationally showed abortion rates dramatically down in the U.S. However, what we've seen, these rates of decline are less in Black and Hispanic teens than in Caucasian and Asian teens. And the abortion rate amongst poor teens has actually increased substantially. So being poor in this country means that you're at a greater likelihood of having an abortion. So that is a problem. The other disparity that we know is that the waiting period that they're describing is discriminatory against low-income and rural teens and, you know, teens with poor access. Other states have found that that waiting period has allowed for harassment, invasion, and privacy of the woman during that waiting period. And most teens actually have made up their mind before they come for services.
Let me ask Alban Romberg about some of these concerns we're hearing and your response, Alban Romberg.
Well, first of all, the quoting of all these statistics, ACLU and the pro-choice group have very successfully prevented any official statistics from being gathered in California. All these statistics they're talking about are estimates that come from the abortion industry itself, except for Medi-Cal. Now, these physicians that do abortions, they don't hesitate to collect money from Medi-Cal, which requires, of course, a report. That report is really not private because the state does not secretly pay money. The patient's confidentiality is protected, but the physician is not. The Medi-Cal statistics show very large numbers of abortions being performed on minors, young girls, in fact, repeats within the same year, which is one of the things we want to stop and help minors with, is this sexual abuse situation where a minor has abortion after abortion. And there's no intervention taken to stop that and to get the minor the help either from a parent or guardian or from the juvenile court system. Furthermore, this idea that there's been a great reduction, the fact remains, as I say, statistics lie. California has one of the highest abortion rates among young girls in the nation. And even if you would count it and accept that these reductions have occurred, it's hard to know about a reduction when you don't have reliable statistics. But let's assume that they have occurred. They're still the highest among the highest in the United States among minors here, close to being twice the national average. So the idea that this initiative isn't needed or that the problem is solving itself is simply nonsense. It's a very serious problem in the state, and as they say, particularly among minorities and other ethnic groups, which in some cases are, to some extent, exploited by the abortion industry.
Let me get some of your more of your calls on here, and we're going to go next to Jan. Thanks for waiting, Jan. You're on.
Hi. I'm going to have to go in a second because my baby's waking up. But my concern is that all this effort's being put into making teens talk to their parents. Why don't we spend some time and money educating parents so that the parents out there that the teens can't go and talk to, whether they're abusive or distant or whatever their reason is, why do we make it the teen's fault that they have to talk to their parents? Maybe there's a problem with the parents.
Well, first of all,
go ahead, Alvin.
That is
Armour.
Great. I would like to. I would actually.
First of all, let me just say this: our law does not require communication within the family. That's one of the false image that's been put up. The person who has to communicate is the doctor who wishes to perform an abortion. That's the one our law requires them to notify a parent or guardian, or else the minor can go to court and get a waiver of that requirement. We're not attempting to, in some kind of Orwellian way, invade the family home and dictate someone comes into the home and says you have to communicate. The communication required by our initiative is very simple. It's a simple notice from the doctor who is intending to perform an abortion to a parent or guardian or the obtaining of a waiver. All of this talk about family communication either increasing or decreasing, first of all, it would be Orwellian to think that anyone has any reliable information on the level of family communication based upon mere surveys taken from, say, talking to some minors in abortion clinics. We don't know that, and virtually speaking, it's impossible to find something like that out from reliable means. Family communication is an intangible thing, and our initiative does not attempt to mandate that. It simply requires that the parent be notified and restores the parent's right to know.
Jan, you had a
happening.
Response but, to this. Yeah,
yeah. Yes, but my concern is okay, fine, you send this notice to the dad or the mom. Obviously, there's a problem going on, and it's not backed up with any other support for the parent on how to handle it with their teen, and it could be a very horrible situation to just get something out of the blue and not have any way for the parent to know how to deal with that information without maybe becoming abusive or degrading or kicking the teen out maybe. I don't know. It's just I've had friends who've gone both ways, had abortions and have had their children put up for adoption, and there is no simple solution to any of this. And so without having support either for the parent or for the teen in some way, it just doesn't seem like it's going to work.
Well, your agreement on this, Norma Jo Waxman, obviously.
Yeah, I think the caller is making a very important and valid point. And the teens who don't confide in their parents, we've found that they have really good cause. 1 in 3 of them have already either experienced violence or are fearful of experienced violence or being thrown out of their homes. Some of them have experienced neglect. We know that many teens don't live with their parents in their state and may not be living with a legal guardian. So again, I think up to 12% will not be able to access the courts that way. It's also really offensive, I think, that Mr. Romberg is describing physicians not covering up sexual abuse. I was a sexual abuse examiner for the city and county of San Francisco. I also was a sexual abuse examiner for children and adolescents in Oakland. And we are all mandated, all of us, teachers, any social workers, anyone who works with teens and children and adults in the state, to report sexual abuse. This is absolutely offensive and inflammatory that they would suggest that physicians cover this up. We also are offended by the image of a older man dragging a teen to an abortion clinic to have a procedure. It's very carefully screened by counselors and the providers who do these procedures to make sure that the teen's there on their own will, that it's her decision, and that she's not ambivalent. If so, these procedures will not proceed. And we are all mandated under reporting to do this. I think I actually have a case that I wouldn't mind pointing out because I think it really points to some of the things that have been so offensive here. It was a really when I was teaching and practicing adolescent medicine at Children's Oakland, there was a 12-year-old girl who was brought in by her aunt, a loving aunt, who was not her legal guardian, because the mother, who was a crack user, the mother's boyfriend had been molesting her for years. And this 12-year-old teen was pregnant and seeking a procedure. Her aunt helped her obtain that. And, I sort of shudder to think, and the man went to jail. Of course, he was, we reported it, he was arrested, he went to jail. But I sort of shudder to think what would have happened to that young woman if this law was in place.
Well, we'll go to more calls and find out what's on the listeners' minds here. Vicki, you're next. Good morning. Hello, Vicki.
Good morning.
Hi.
Hi. My point is, I don't think this law is mandating parental communication at all. I think what it's doing is leveling the playing field so that parents have an opportunity to know what is happening to their children during school hours, when public schools have the opportunity to take these girls off campus for a secret abortion, no medical history is available from the parents, and the parents won't even know if there are complications until they get called down to a hospital. This isn't about communication. This is about safety for the teenager.
How about that, Maggie Crosby? And certainly we've heard that from those who are in favor of Prop 73, that that safety is and ought to be figured in this whole equation.
Oh, safety is absolutely critical, but that's why people who are concerned with teen safety are on the no side of 73. And I think it's important to start from the perspective that the current system does not exclude parents. Most teens go to their parents. They are strongly encouraged to go to their parents by clinicians. And if the structure is there, then they will indeed speak with a parent. And this system, Prop 73, does not include parents, because if the teen cannot safely go to her parents, she just won't. It's true that the way it works is that that the doctor sends a government-scripted form, two envelopes, to the parents. I mean, the idea that this somehow is going to enhance family communication to have that arrive at the breakfast table is just silly. But it's up to the teen as to whether she will allow that notification to go out. And she and every study shows, the real-world experience shows, that she simply won't allow that notification to go out if it's going to cause an explosion in her family. And by the way, we hear that this is just notification, not consent. But we have to look at it through the eyes of the teen and the power balance in that family. If a teen fears that she's going to be beaten, she's going to be thrown out of the house, they're going to force her to have a baby when she's not ready, she's just not going to allow that notification. And so then, returning to the issue of safety, what happens to her? Well, some will go to court, some will travel out of state, some will turn in desperation to self-induced abortion procedures. And by the way, we do see these in other states. There's a horrible story out of Michigan of a teen who just could not have her parents notified. As Norma Jo Waxman says, usually these are very good reasons for that. And she asked her boyfriend to hit her in the abdomen with a baseball bat, which he did, until she did indeed have a miscarriage, and he's being prosecuted criminally. You know, scared teens do scary things, and therefore, for those of us who care about safety, vote no on proposition.
Yes, Catherine Short, about this distinction between, I mean, from a teen's mind, I'm certain you would concede, Catherine Short, that the difference between notification and consent might be minimal, if at all existent.
Well, no, I mean, the notification, what can happen is when the minor realizes that her parents have to be notified, she doesn't have to wait for a letter to come. She can go and tell her parents. I mean, the parents have no right to stop her from obtaining the abortion. And we, frankly, we recognize that in most cases, the parent, once notified, they're not even going to try to talk her out of it. They will probably take her to the clinic, and they will maybe and make sure that the doctor gets a full medical history, be on the alert for any post-abortion complications. That's what's going to happen. But that's what would say, well, why are you supporting it? It's because we realize it's not about necessarily about this abortion and this pregnancy. It's about the next one and the next one.
Oh.
And that's where, you know, as I say, the record of these things, these laws, is that they reduce teen abortions and teen pregnancies. Teens are more careful about getting pregnant. Teens, you know, the thing about them going out of state, I can't tell you how many times that these statistics go flowing by, and I see, you know, the distortion of the statistics in these other studies. What these other studies showing the out-of-state abortions, they play with the statistics. They've never shown that the out-of-state abortions actually make up for the reduction in the in-state abortions. You know, yes, some minors will travel out of state. That's true. But overall, they reduce teen abortions and teen pregnancies. And we don't see minors being abused. I mean, these are just it's just a common sense thing that needs that parents should know that their daughter is pregnant. I mean, that's one thing, know that their daughter is pregnant and that she's seeking an abortion. And I just don't see you can always bring up some case. I mean, you could say the same thing about airbags, you know. You could always come up with a horror story about airbags. But by and large, minors aren't helped by secret abortions.
Well, you've questioned a lot of statistics here. I'm wondering about the statistic that Planned Parenthood has put out, that in cases, you've got almost sometimes a third of youngsters who are pregnant having some kind of abuse.
That's a perfect example of the sort of statistic. It comes from this one study, and that's what gets me, is there's this one study by a pro-abortion surveyist, and not content with the results of that, they twist the results of that to make it even more pro, to support their work. What the study did was it surveyed minors, and it assumed, it said, how many of you told your parents? How many of your parents found out another way? And then it looked at the subgroup of the parents who found out another way. And it assumes that parents finding out, over the back fence would be the equivalent situation of a parental notification law. I mean, so they made that sort of extrapolation. The second thing is what the study said was 30%, this is 30% of minors feared either that they might be thrown out of the home or would experience some violence. Now, again, we're talking about the reaction of minors, what they're reporting in a survey. We're not talking about what happened. We're talking about what they are saying to a surveyist about why they didn't tell their parents.
I'm getting some disagreement from Dr. Waxman here.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually not true, and it included teens that were also had a history of abuse. What also is very concerning, though, I think there's a couple of things that we are really worried about, is that we know that when confidentiality is threatened in the physician-patient relationship, confidentiality is key for all patients, but especially with teens. And when that trust is broken, what has been found is that teens won't come in for any care. Teens are confused, and they may not understand that this Notification Act around abortion would not also cover contraceptive services or STD services. And when a study was done in 2002, showed that if parental notification for contraceptives were mandated, 50% of teens would just stop using contraception, but 99% would not stop having sex. I think it's also, if you're really saying that this is a parental right issue and a parent should need to know, I'm really sort of curious why language wasn't added that a parent should be notified if the teen chooses to continue her pregnancy. Because, frankly, that's not anywhere in any of these states. And if a teen chooses to continue her pregnancy, which some of them do, and some of them would be forced to have an abortion if they notified their parents. I actually have a friend who's a physician who has a son that's adopted that was the product of a teen mom who hid her pregnancy because she would have been forced to have an abortion. I think it's important to wonder what is your real intent if we don't have to notify, teens don't have to notify their parents if they continue their pregnancy, and that both, not that they shouldn't continue their pregnancy that if that's what they desire, but both pregnancy and childbirth are much more dangerous than any abortion procedure. They're just the higher mortality.
You put the questions out there. Catherine Short, did you want to respond?
I'd like to respond to that.
Then let's hear from Alvin Rummer. Go ahead.
Yes. This is sheer nonsense. We're talking about as if nobody knows how nature works. Teenagers do not have secret children who disappear from the family. Nobody knows anything about them.
No, but they have
pregnancy
no
obviously
care.
Becomes obvious unless there's no connection and the parents and the child don't live with each other. So some of these scenarios that they're talking about are fables. Also, this occasionally resorting then to anecdotes and statistics about surveys, we in turn have had telephone calls placed to all the Planned Parenthood clinics in California setting forward a situation of a 13-year-old seeking an abortion after having sex with a 22-year-old. Every single Planned Parenthood clinic coached the girl on how to avoid any reporting and offered then to provide her with birth control after they provided her with a secret abortion to continue, so the abuse could continue. We can play those. There are transcripts. They're available on the Internet. The listener can listen to themselves.
Michael, that is evidence
of the reality of what's going on here.
I want to go to an email here because we haven't heard from any of our listeners via email, and a lot of the callers are, share the sentiments of Maggie Crosby and Dr. Waxman. But here's a listener from in Woodland, California, who says, it's not unusual for a minor child to be afraid to talk to his or her parents about mistakes like failing a test, getting a traffic ticket, or wrecking the family car. Society doesn't find it acceptable for children to hide this information. Rather, society holds parents responsible, both financially and morally, for the actions of their offspring. Being afraid to talk about a pregnancy doesn't mean that that fear should be honored. Counselors or other caring adults should offer to help the pregnant minor speak with her parents. And This is also another emailer kind of attached to this, wants Maggie Crosby to tell him why, since California already requires minors to get parental permission to obtain piercings, why should abortion be treated differently? Well, again, these kind of things coincide in some ways because they suggest that notification ought to be necessary. It ought to be necessary to at least afford a vehicle by which parents can be consulted and can be brought into the process. And Maggie Crosby, I'd like some sense of your reaction to that.
Well, my reaction to it is that there are many things the government can do. Making your teenager talk to you is not one of them. California allows teens to get a whole range of care related to sexuality, such as treatment for sexually transmitted diseases or drug or alcohol problems or mental health problems. Mm-hmm. Without parental involvement, because what's most important to us is that we not erect barriers to health care. And there is no way that Prop 73 or any other law is going to make every teen talk to every parent. We don't live in an Ossie and Harriet world. There are so many stories of abuse and dysfunction that would, you know, these are our most vulnerable teens, and this will simply harm them. I do have to respond to two things that are total fantasies that have been said on this call. One is this idea that there are all these repeat abortions among teenagers. Mm-hmm. The reason the proponents are saying that is that in our case, every court found that laws like this do not influence teen behavior. They do not bring down the pregnancy rates. And the reason is teens very rarely know what the law is. I mean, for one thing, they'd have to know it to change their behavior. So the proponents have now come up with this idea of, gee, well, maybe it doesn't avoid the first pregnancy, but maybe the second or third. Well, there is no second and third. I mean, that is just a scare tactic on their part. And more importantly, I have to say that this so-called study that was done of Planned Parenthood not fulfilling its obligations as child abuse reporters, all it proved was that the people who did it didn't know what the child abuse reporting laws were because there was no violation, whatever. And this accusation that has been thrown around, for example, at the federal level, a Congress asked...
Ms. Crosby, I'm afraid I'm going to have to cut you there because we're flat out of time. We started with Mr. Romberg. We'll end with you. I want to extend my appreciation to all of you for your participation in a most illuminating debate. Now it's up to the voters. Thanks to Alvin Romberg and to Catherine Short and to Dr. Norma Jo Waxman and Maggie Crosby for being our guests. And thanks to all of you, our listeners and callers and emailers. Another hour of forum coming your way. We're going to talk about breast cancer, prevention and cures in the hour ahead, and treatment. Hope you will join us for that. Our producers are Robin Giannatasio-Mal, Kevin Guillory and Ariana Peccary. Our engineer is Howard Gelman. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.